Oh, hey, we're live. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty, in my very comfortable sweater because it's a little chilly in the Rocky Mountain Empire today. And with me is a huge round table of folks to talk to RPG designer Owen Casey Williams. How you doing, Owen?
Williams. Hi.
Williams. Why did I say Williams? Stevens. God, I apologize.
We blame the energy drink.
It's like written up there, so it shouldn't be an issue.
This is actually pure seltzer water.
It was when you opened it. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Lala.
Thank you, Lala.
Okay. I earned that. Let me just introduce everyone real fast. A person we call Lala sometimes is Alice Peng. How you doing, Alice?
Hi, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
All right. Mr. Jacob Blattman, RPG writer and artist extraordinaire. How you doing, Jacob?
Always a pleasure.
And wearing the KTF hat, which means probably what you think it means, is Walt Rebilliard, also an RPG writer and a studio owner. How you doing, Walt?
Hola, my coffee does not sparkle like your water.
Indeed, indeed. But it's more caffeinated, so things even out. So we're doing a series called RPG Behind the Scenes, where the idea is we abstain from our usual pop culture obsessions and fart jokes and focus more on the creative side of the RPG business.
Frequently full of pop culture references and fart jokes. So.
Fair
enough.
More
than you think.
You guys go to more conventions than I do, so I will accept that as gospel. So we're going to talk to Owen about his career, his inspirations, his creative process. And Owen, on the off chance there is some poor benighted soul listening to our podcast or watching it live on YouTube via StreamYard who is unfamiliar with your body of work, could you give us just kind of a brief summary of your resume and your credentials?
Sure. I started writing for magazines in the 1990s, and the entire point there was to try and make enough money writing for magazines to afford a Dragon magazine subscription. That is literally originally all I was trying to do, was be able to afford a subscription because I was Poe. While all my friends were getting college degrees and learning useful skills, all I was doing was writing for magazines and playing games. So when it became time to be an adult and try to make a living, I discovered that games were the only things I had a professional level of skill in. So I went to the TSR Writers Conference in 1997, which was in Seattle, which was after Wizards of the Coast and bought TSR. I applied for a job at TSR in 2000 and weirdly got it, although I'm told that my application fell behind a filing cabinet, so I would have been hired a few months earlier if that hadn't happened. Got laid off 14 months after I was hired, but that was the age of the D20 boom. So I was then working on Star Wars D20 and EverQuest, the D20 tabletop game, and Wheel of Time, and a whole bunch of conversion work and a bunch of stuff for Green Ronin, which has been one of the linchpins of my career. I was continuing to work on the magazine, so when Paizo Publishing took over the Dragon and Dungeon magazines, I did a lot of work with them. Then they ended up spinning off Pathfinder. I wrote The Guide to Absalom, which was one of their first Pathfinder books before there was a Pathfinder role-playing game. It came out while they were still in the 3.5 era. Did a lot of freelance with them. Joined up with a couple guys named Stan, an exclamation point, and Hiram Savage for Super Genius Games. Eventually, we parted ways. I got bought out, which was fine. And I started Rogue Genius Games. And I continued to do that. Did so much work for Paizo that I was calling editor-in-chief Wes Schneider so often that he hired me so I would stop calling him. And that lasted until earlier this year when I left that job, having worked on Pathfinder First Edition and having been the design lead for the Starfinder role-playing game. And then my wife and I packed it up and moved to Indiana when she got a job with Lone Wolf. And now I'm the fantasy age developer for Green Ronin, which has only been true for less than a month now, 21 days. So it's not quite at the top of my mind yet, even though that's probably the highest profile thing I'm doing right now.
Well, congratulations on the new job.
Thank you.
And I guess the bonus there is that the cost of living in Evansville, Indiana must be significantly more affordable than it.
The cost of living in Evansville, Indiana is 38% of what the cost of living in Redmond, which is a suburb of Seattle, was. So it's less than half. It's almost a third. The fact of the matter is that, I mean, I was well paid by Paizo. That was a full-time job with benefits, and it had a certain stability to it. And I missed the stability and the full-time benefits. But I only have to make a third as much money, half as much money if I'm paying for my own benefits to have the same lifestyle out here.
So is Indiana hiring? I mean, you know.
the job that we were hired for went away a few months after we moved here. So I can't necessarily recommend moving to
Indiana. Oh, no, I was talking about like cutting grass or something like that. Because if it's a third of what I'm paying here,
yeah, it is
like a king.
I mean, there are fast food jobs, right? Which you can, this is one of the places where you can pay the rent on a fast food job. The jobs are generally speaking more than minimum wage, and the apartments are, especially if you get a one bedroom, they're cheap. I mean, there are houses out here that cost less than my car.
No, can't confirm. Wow. Like I said in the pre-show, I grew up in Indiana, and that's all factual. Heck, you can those rich suburbs where the high school kids don't want to work.
Yeah,
you can make $12-$15 working fast food.
Absolutely.
And you know, you don't have to compete with, in Redmond, you're competing with all those folks from Microsoft. In Evansville, I guess you're competing with people from the miniature golf courses and the slaughterhouse for housing. So.
Seven mini golf courses, one of which is open at 6 a.m., which just seems excessive. I'm actively suspicious that there's some sort of mini golf cult ritual that I have not worked out yet, that you've inscribed something on the ball and it goes through all the patterns. I'm looking into that yet. I mean, this is also the last place in the United States that sells brain sandwiches on a regular basis. It's literally Bloodstown.
Go find your local costume shop. Maybe you'll find the robes that they use for those rituals at the mini golf.
Yeah, well, it's cheap enough here. They probably just buy them, right? You don't have
to. You don't want to rent your ritual robes because there's blood and who knows what other kind of fluid. It's a whole thing. But
well, I mean, it's a lot like a car, right? If you figure you need new robes every 2 years, then you look at the leasing cost. True.
That's why I buy my fezes. I don't rent.
And the dry cleaning bill's insane, right?
The dry cleaning bill can be. Well, and they clearly clean them with gasoline, given how flammable cult robes always seem to be in the movies. So, that is obviously a cost-saving measure, just scrub kerosene or turpentine on it or something.
You knock over one candelabra, they just go up.
Yeah.
Okay, now, Owen, you have to write a module of the mini golf robe-wearing cultists now. I
might do that. One of the interesting things about the fact that I'm back to being a full-time freelancer is that a chunk of what I do is work for Rogue Genius Games, which means I'm working for myself, since I and my wife and our friend Stan are owners of that company. So it does mean that, I mean, I did a Cannibal Clown Starfinder supplement, right, where there's literally a undead nanite virus disease that turns humanoids into flesh-eating magical clowns. That's not a product I am likely to get another company to publish, but it has done very well for us, actually. It's one of our better sellers, so it's nice to be able to occasionally say, hey, we're going to make a edible board game called Gingerbread Kaiju, or we're going to do Cannibal Clowns from Outer Space, or I'm going to do Psychic Cats from Space, as another example. We also publish Alex Agunis, who does Everybody Games, and he is a joke product, released a humanoid kangaroo for Pathfinder as a playable species a few years ago, and it was a big hit. He's now done them for Starfinder and then follow-up products. You never know exactly what the market wants, and that's one of the things that being a small, fast, flexible company means. You can throw some stuff at the wall, and if it sticks, you can follow it up.
Yeah, it seems like most of the money is always in, you know, doing 3E, 4E, 5E, you know, whatever Wizards is doing. But, yeah, you can find those niches that people haven't tried before, like Psychic Cats from Space, which I think would be a huge seller just because Psychic Cats from Space.
I mean, our marketing text is literally either you think this is a good idea or you don't, right? We're not going to talk anyone into Psychic Cats from Space, but there's definitely a market for them.
You know, if I ever retire, get run over by a bus, and just living on disability, I'm just going to write all cat RPGs all the time.
Well, I mean, there's Pugmire, and it's got the Monasteries of Meow,
yeah.
That are dog and cat RPGs. That's a niche. Pony Finder for Pathfinder is a popular My Little Pony pastiche of Pathfinder, and it does well.
Yeah, there's little niches out there. I run Fading Goat Games, which is, you know, much smaller operator than even Rogue Genius. And I've noticed certain things, like we do mainly superhero games, which are already a small niche.
Yep.
But, you know, there's certain things, World War II products, especially if they have a really nice cover, always seem to sell well for us. So, so you're doing Fantasy Age now. Tell us a little bit about that.
So, Fantasy Age is Green Ronin's, generic's the wrong word, but sort of universal fantasy role-playing game. It is designed to be simple enough to get into quickly and easily, but be flexible enough to allow you to make the character you want to make. A big part of what makes it different and exciting is it's got a stunt die mechanic. So you roll 3d6. If any two of them are doubles, then you get a number of stunt points equal to your stunt die, and that lets you do cool stuff. The nice thing about the stunt die is that in other games, I find that generally speaking, cool stuff either happens all the time because, like in a superhero game, maybe you can just buy a cool power, but then you're doing it all the time and it becomes mundane eventually. Or because cool stuff tends to be quite powerful, it is restricted to, for instance, the critical hit. Pardon me. So that it's like 5% or less of interesting things happening. And frequently, the GM and the player are really left to come up with what is the interesting thing that happens. With Fantasy Age, we've got a stunt system, and we have universal stunts that everyone can get, and then you can, with special abilities, access specific stunts. And some things cause different number of stunt points. So if you just earned one stunt point, you can do a slightly cool thing. If you got six stunt points, you can do an incredibly cool thing. But you never know when it's going to happen, and it really helps keep the game interesting and flexible, so it's not just constantly saying, I shoot fireball, I hit him with my sword. Which, you know, once you find a single best tactical option in an RPG, frequently you are stuck doing that unless it has a narrative system, in which case you have to think of the interesting thing you do all the time. I like how Fantasy Age, and we've had Modern Age and The Expanse and Blue Rose spin off the same AGE system, which was originally used for Dragon Age, which was licensed from the RPG, from the computer RPG. I like that it creates unexpected different levels of cool things, and the players have agency on, okay, I've gotten my stunt points, I'll use them for this big thing, or I'll do something smaller, or I will build my character to have access to more stunt abilities, etc. So that I've been involved with the system in a very tangential way from the beginning. I have a credit in the Dragon Age tabletop RPG, the box set, for having worked on the GM system. But that GM system was largely taken for things I'd already written for Green Ronin. And just, I tweaked it slightly. Actually, Chris tweaked it originally, and then for Fantasy Age, I tweaked to the Dragon Age version. So I was doing a little stuff with AGE, which is the Adventure Game Engine. But this is my first really heavy involvement with it, and it's interesting because I am largely known as a D20 guy, having hit my full-time freelance during the D20 boom. So D&D 3.0, 3.5. I worked on all of the D20 Star Wars games. I was one of the co-writers of Saga Edition. I think I got 6 or 7 or 8 D20 core rulebooks under my belt, and that is what most people know me for. And this is a very similar kind of game, but it is 3D6 instead of a D20. It's got a different set of mechanics. It's not nearly as crunchy where you have to worry about, hey, did I get a trait that gives me a +1 if I'm using this weapon that I picked up through a racial ability for an archetype? Right, it's not that complicated. It's designed to be fast and interesting and fun, and to get to it quickly.
You know, I've got this horrible guy in my head who wants to make a joke about, hey, so when are we getting a superhero book for Age? And I'm not going to ask that. That would be weird and inappropriate, and I certainly won't do that.
I mean, you know, Steve Kenson works for Green Ronin. Steve Kenson is well known for having done Mutants and Masterminds, and then having done Icons, and I'm sure he's written a couple of superhero RPGs that we just don't see very often. I can't say that I've never thought, you know, it seems like the Age engine would work well for superheroes of a certain type. But that would not be from the Fantasy Age line. So even if that were going to happen, it wouldn't be my thing to announce.
So to any of our listeners or viewers on YouTube right now, I have posted the links for Green Ronin's store to Fantasy Age and to Rogue Genius Games off DriveThruRPG. DriveThruRPG doesn't seem to be working, at least last time I tried them. But the links
are
there. Yeah, they were having some issues yesterday when I was trying to use them.
I was just able to get in just now, so maybe
it's working again today.
Okay.
Maybe they crimped the aluminum foil around the bunny ears, and things are okay at the moment. So.
Now, one of the things I gotta say about the age system, I haven't gotten to I had an opportunity to play it yet, but I've gotten to read the books and I really enjoy them in its simplicity, and especially with the stunt mechanics system, because there isn't just stunt mechanics for combat. There's also stunt mechanics for when you're casting magic. There's stunt mechanics for social interactions. They have stunt mechanics for a lot of different things. So there's something special for any aspect of the game that you'll enjoy.
Oh, cool. I guess it begs the question, since you've just taken the helm of the ship, what's coming out now from the Good Ship Fantasy Age?
We just announced that we are going to be doing print-on-demand spell cards so that you can pick just the spells you have. You tend to just have a few flexible spells with Fantasy Age characters, but it's still nice to have just the ones you've got with you. And, you know, if your table is using one rule book, for example, and someone else is looking something else up, it can be useful. I did a Ronin round table on the Green Ronin website that also talked about the fact that if you've got a set of cards with all the spells in the game, as a GM, there are things you can do to play with those to randomize effects, right? So you can say, okay, I'm going to deal four spells, and that's what this hag has, and whatever they are, we'll make it work. So that's a tangible way to use those cards for a randomizing effect. And then we've got a campaign builder's guide coming out, and everything that I'm actually going to be working on is unannounced yet. But there's, you know, you don't hire a developer unless you are moving forward with the game system. So we've got plans in place, and it's no accident that I have worked for Green Ronin in a number of different capacities before. I'm not an expert on Fantasy Age yet. I'm getting there. But, you know, I told them that. They said, well, we want your talents for the things we're looking at doing, and we know we can work with you because, Green Ronin is much bigger than Rogue Genius, for example, but it's still a small independent company that's owned by the people that do most of the work for it. And it's very important in the tabletop game industry that you are working with people that you like working with, that you don't have personality conflicts with, that you don't constantly fail to see eye to eye with.
Because there are some quirky people in the industry, I've heard.
There is a few here and there, yeah. Is a kind description.
Can I just start throwing out possible licensed properties and you will say warm or cold?
I will not say warm or cold. I'll tell you whether or not I think it's a good idea, but I will give you no inside information on what Green Ronin is doing.
Beastmaster.
I think that's a terrible idea for a license. And seriously, the core idea of a character that plays with animals and animal companions, great. Beastmaster in particular, I suppose if you're talking about the Andre Norton science fiction novel that was originally horribly mauled to make a fantasy movie, that might have some more interesting depth to it. But the movies, I enjoy them, don't get me wrong, but there's not enough there to justify a license.
I'm guessing that we'll see Freeport before we see anything else.
I don't know about before anything else, but certainly I was the Freeport Pathfinder developer. We are no longer producing new Pathfinder Freeport books. The 20th anniversary for Green Ronin is coming up. Freeport is our original sort of main ship of the line. So I would expect to see some stuff for it and the other games coming out.
What about Critters?
As a license? So Critters is the sort of thing that would be fun to do a license if what you want is a one-shot introductory product. That is similar to, for example, what Wizards of the Coast did with Rick and Morty, right? They have an introductory product that is tied to Rick and Morty. They did the same thing with Stranger Things. But Critters does not have the buy-in that either of those do. Now, there's a new Critters movie coming out, and there's a new Critters television series coming out. So it's actually sort of in ascendancy as licensing goes. But I would think that, you know, right now what we have for a license for science fiction at Green Ronin is The Expanse. And I don't think that Critters is primarily going to be appealing to the crowd that is then going to say, all right, I'm going to hop over to The Expanse or I'm going to hop over to Modern Age. It's also, again, it's so easy to pastiche. Like, I would not license Killer Clowns from Outer Space, but I sure released Cannibal Clowns from Outer Space for Starfinder. It's not exactly the same. For example, they don't have a cotton candy weapon. And one of the reasons it's not the same is that I did not study my inspiration before writing it, right? I saw some art of a killer clown that was available as stock art. And my wife said, do you think you can write a product around this? And I was like, yeah, I really think I can.
Now, did you say it like that, or did you say, hold my beer?
Well, I'm not much of a beer drinker, but I did write that entire product in, what, 2 hours?
That's
when she said she hit it to me. It was all slapped together in a first draft, and then we edited it, and then we put it out. Sometimes when the muse strikes for a weird idea, that is just the time to leap forward and do it.
Speaking of which... Sorry, Mike, go ahead.
No, please. I was going to make stupid jokes about 80s fantasy movies. You should probably go ahead, Mel.
Well, I was just going to ask, where do you usually get all your zany ideas from?
So my zany ideas, if you go back to the very, very, very root, come from the fact that I was raised in a geek household. When I was in kindergarten, my mother read The Hobbit to myself and my sister as our bedtime story. The hallway to my bedroom in our house was the household library, and it had Isaac Asimov and Heinlein and Otis Albert Klein, Edgar Rice Burroughs and Moorcock and McCaffrey, and for that matter, Mercedes Lackey was coming up through her early career in the area at the time, so I got to hear her do readings of her books at small local conventions. So I was hooked on science fiction and fantasy, including really pulpy John Carter of Mars stuff super early. And I've just been absorbing pretty much everything I can ever since then. So my inspirations range from, oh, hey, that was one of my favorite vehicles in an episode of Speed Racer. I wonder if I can base a starship off that. To, okay, I need to write something for tomorrow's article. I will turn on the Sci-Fi Channel. Sharknado. Well, I don't know if I can be that ridiculous, but gosh, they've had a bunch of sequels, so surely we can do some weather-based animal hazard templates, even if we, you know, have the Barracuda cane instead.
Jacob and I produced a product for M&M called Sharkacane.
Yeah, exactly. I absorb a lot of geek content. I mean, the reason this is still my job is that I am still having fun doing it. That's the other reason. The first one being that I never learned any useful skills. So weird, zany ideas is pretty much where I live. I watch a lot of anime. I read a lot of books still. I follow a bunch of people online. I am trying to take in input all the time. And during the D20 boom, it was often really useful if someone said, hey, are you familiar with X? To be able to at least say, well, I mean, I'm not an expert, but... you know, like when we were working on the EverQuest D20 role-playing game. Or have you ever played EverQuest? Well, I've never played it, but I've got a friend who's in a great big guild and does raids and has a max level character. I know my barbarians from my erudites. And the fact that I was able to name two of the races that are not necessarily obvious meant that they said, okay, he's got some clue. And then if you've got a rough background on a lot of things, you ever heard of Magi Nation? Sure, I've heard of it. Mm-hmm. Then if you get the job, you can bone up on it, which is much easier in the age of Wikipedia and other online resources than it was when I was first getting started. When I got hired by Wizards of the Coast in 2000 to work on the Star Wars role-playing game, I was told, you're going to have to go buy a copy of the Star Wars Encyclopedia. And I'm like, well, don't you all have one? Well, we all have our own copy. But we can't get you one for free, and you're going to have to look stuff up on it. So we're telling you, you've got to have a copy of the Star Wars Encyclopedia. Okay, I guess I'm buying a copy of the Star Wars Encyclopedia. But, you know, once you own one of those, you've got it for quite a while. And they had the Jedi Holocron for more detailed questions. But it's much easier in the age of there being a wiki for everything to at least get a basic idea where you're looking for stuff.
Well, quick question. This is kind of it's becoming the go-to question I have for all of these kind of interviews. A lot of writers have a specific process, you know, whether it be more pragmatic and saying I'm going to write for the next hour or the next 20 minutes, or, you know, if you're a little more, let's say, fancy about it, you know, I have to be drinking my tea from my mug at this, you know, this window at this table. And what's your process like for that?
It's It's a little different recently because I was working at Paizo most of the time for 5 years. And so a big part of the process was Paizo work happens at Paizo, and my freelance work happens at home in an effort to firewall those things. But I do have a preferred comfortable setup, right? I'm at my desk. I've got my reference books. I've got, you know, stuff over here. I have things to take my mind off of whatever I'm doing if I have to throw my brain in neutral for a bit. Sometimes if I run into a problem, I can't come up with a solution just by grinding on it. I have to let that problem be the last thing I thought about and do something entirely neutral. That is, for example, sometimes when I work on diesel pulp Weird War miniatures, which I have carefully kept out of my career, so that remains my hobby zen, right? If I do anything with fantasy or science fiction or science fantasy figures, that feels like I'm preparing to run like a Starfinder game. I still write Starfinder freelance, so that's part of my job. It's important to me to have some geeky hobby things that aren't part of my job, so I can throw my brain in neutral, work on something, and then see if a solution just pops up. I tend to work in bursts. I usually sort of wake up in the morning, take a look at social media, make sure that if I have a blog post due for the day, that's ready to go. If we're going to have a product uploaded for Rogue Genius, or I'm also a producer for Wright Publishing, make sure that that is ready to go. If anyone has written to me, if there are customer complaints, if there's a, I mean, one day I woke up and Reddit had the trial of Owen Casey Stevens on as one of the threads. So nowadays you have to make sure that there isn't some sort of smear campaign going on that you need to at least be aware of if people are going to try and make people not hire you. And then I look at what my deadlines are. And if I've got stuff I have to work on a deadline, that gets a chunk of time. And then as the day goes on, I am more likely to drift away from scheduled things and more just see where my muse takes me, which is where your Cannibal Clowns and Space Cats kind of programs come from.
Fair enough, fair enough. I guess we should mention you've got a bunch of little side projects in Rogue Genius. You've been blogging about your Weird West setting that uses the Starfinder setting, Starfinder rules.
Yep, it's called Really Wild West. I haven't actually made a new post on it in a while, but the archive is still on my website. So you can go to owncaseystevens.com and search for Really Wild West, and the index will show up, which shows all the articles. I am working on a magic and advanced science Old West campaign setting, which will at least be 99% Starfinder compatible. These are the Starfinder core rules and core races. We're just adding new stuff and reskinning some things for people that think playing cowboys versus aliens in the Valley of Guanji against Dracula sounds like fun.
That does sound like fun.
Well, good. And Jacob, just to, yeah, last night, I found that Guntana that I had you do in 2013 that I flat forgot.
I did a ton of those for you.
Yeah, and they have never gone anywhere because that project got killed by the fact that I started Rogue Genius and then got hired by Green Ronin and then got hired by Paizo. So I'm going to ask you to find and resend me those so I can do Really Wild West stats for them.
Absolutely.
So inspiration list, the other thing that sometimes happens is you're going through resources you have access to that either you can buy or that you already have, and you think, ooh, I should do something with this. Especially since I've been doing this for 23 sort of mumble years. Sometimes I just go through old unfinished articles and documents and campaign notes, and frequently I find things that are terrible, but that have a core interesting idea that I can do better now with my experience.
Fair enough. Speaking of ideas you can do better with experience, how about Krull?
So I have a entirely unironic deep love of Krull. Ari Marmel and I both have regularly talked about wanting to do a Krull reboot. I have written up a very Krull-inspired throwing star weapon, the Kotos, on my blog, and Jacob did the art for it. So I love Krull. I would license Krull. I would totally do a Krull role-playing game. If the question is, do I think that's a good idea? No, I don't. I don't think a Krull role-playing game is a good idea. What could be a good idea, instead of a license, is to make the awesome 80s fantasy RPG that has throwing stars and three-bladed swords and giant snakes and sorcerer people and time travel and demon dogs and swords of light and yes, and darkness and unicorns and scale mail armor and bogs of eternal sadness, and just throw all that into one game as a series of inspirations and pastiches, because I think there's a lot there you could do, but I don't think you're going to get enough people who are interested just in a crawl role-playing game to make that worth the license, because even cheap licenses frequently are relatively expensive. Now, there is a licensing fair that happens, and actually there are several of them, where you can go see what licenses are out there. I've had a conversation with a very serious publisher about licensing, for example, the movie The Stuff, not because it is going to be any kind of epic nostalgia or it's just begging to happen, but because the license is super cheap. And if you do something small and fast without putting too much money into it, you will get some people buying it just because what the heck is someone doing making an RPG about evil yogurt?
All right, I'm on board with the evil yogurt. That's cool. You addressed all of my other silly comments about 80s fantasy movies. I had all these other movie posters just queued up. I was going to shoot at you. Instead, I will just share this image that Jacob drew of science agents in your really Wild West setting.
Yep, those are science agents from the Mexican Periferio, which are amongst the most respected of law enforcement agents in that setting. And one of the things that's happening in that setting is that there was the War of the Worlds invasion of the Martians, and humans have been retrofitting and updating the technology. So you see here that our science agent up front has a lightning gun with battery on her belt, but also has just a backup regular old pistol. And the Mexican Periferio is an interesting time where there actually was a government in Mexico that believed that science was the solution to everything. The powerful elite were known as the Scientificos. And it's not something I've ever seen much of anyone do anything else with, and the time period is about right. So I wanted to take some things that had been done one way. I mean, Mexico is frequently the place where bandits flee to in Western-style games, and it's a lot more than that, right? It's a sovereign, powerful nation, and it's had a lot of different governments and a lot of history behind it. So I wanted to draw on that in a different way to create something new for that setting. And I love this piece that Jacob did. And there's a super short piece of fiction that goes with it.
Yeah, it's definitely pretty cool. Jacob, did you ever do a picture for Really Wild West of a Rikasha gunslinger?
That wasn't specifically for Real Wild West. That was for the Talented Bestiary, also for Rogue Genius Games, but it might as well be for Real Wild West.
I have, in fact, written up the Rikshasa Gunslinger for Really Wild West. I did a series of things showing how to make monsters in Starfinder using the Really Wild West as an example. So I did this, and I did a grizzly boar, and I did a rattle cat, and I did a prickle bison. I don't remember what I ended up calling it. But basically, it's, of course, cross between a buffalo and a porcupine.
Okay, cool. If you were starting out in RPGs today, what advice would you give to someone looking to get into it as a freelance designer or writer?
Don't do most of the things I did, and a lot of them just won't work anymore. I think at this point, you're going to want to approach small publishers and see if they have any small things that they are interested in having people do. I also think at this point, it's important to have a social media presence. I think you're going to want to have a blog. I think if you don't have enough work from other people to eat up your time, the way to be a better writer is to write. So if you can't get someone else to pay you for your work, put it up on your blog, or put together a full PDF if you want to teach yourself those skills. I don't necessarily recommend you become a publisher in general, because being a publisher is a lot more work than just writing an RPG. But you can self-publish some things so that you've got some credits out there so that people know who you are and what you can do. One of the things I'm doing with Really Wild West, right, is I'm using it as content for my blog, which is also therefore content for my Patreon, while I am writing up rules and paying for art slowly. Art can be expensive. Jacob's an excellent artist. I want a lot of his art in this book, and I want to have half-orcs and androids and Lashunta in my really Wild West setting, but I don't want to pay for all of that all at once. So by making these things part of that content, I'm getting a collection of things I can pull together later. Even if I was just starting, I would be able to either find stock art or pay an artist like Jacob for one piece and say, hey, I had an idea for example, one spell for Pathfinder 2nd Edition, maybe. There are also a lot of things that use the Open Game License or Creative Commons licenses now, so that is a great way to find things that you can write for and still make money on and that people are looking for. Once you have a few credits, I recommend you start dropping lines to bigger and bigger companies and ask Green Ronin, right? Do you all have any room for a writer? Here are my credits. Contact the various developers and designers at Paizo. Talk to people at Wizards of the Coast. Talk to people at Fantasy Flight. There's a pretty good turnover on freelancers. A lot of people get in this, do a few things, and either move up or move out. You know, I've got Tunnels and Trolls adventures written by Mike Stackpole, but that's not what he does anymore. So there's always people looking for good, reliable, interesting, creative writers. Just start putting your name out there and don't wait for someone to tell you what to write. Start writing your own stuff so that when someone says, well, do you have an example of your writing? You can say, yeah, I wrote rules for gambling for Starfinder, and here they are. And you can read them and get feedback on them.
That's actually a really good point that you bring up, that you need to get stuff out there. But what's your take on the importance of self-promotion, and how do you feel people are best to do that, especially for a lot of introverted gamers who are writing and creating, and they are like, I don't want to go promote myself.
So I am a big booster of self-promotion, and I am an introvert. I will curl up with a blanket and sip hot cocoa after this interview to make up for having expended the energy to be upbeat and cheerful and talk to people. But one of the great things about, as an introvert, boosting yourself online is I can write a blog post, post it up, and then not look at it for 3 days if I need to. It's up, it's there, I don't have to talk to anyone. Same with Twitter, same with Facebook. I think a strong social media presence and a good blog presence are extremely helpful, but there are successful people in the industry who don't do any of those things. You know, one of my coworkers who ended up being the creative director for Starfinder, Rob McCreary, brilliant designer, great writer, great guy, doesn't really want to spend a lot of time doing promotion, but he did the RPG Superstar contest when that was around, and then he did a few pieces of freelance, and then he applied for an editing job, and he worked his way up through the company. So it's harder, in my opinion, if you don't self-promote, just like it's harder if you don't go to conventions. It's harder if you don't already know people. But for example, I did not know people when I got into this industry, so I went to conventions, and I went to the TSR Writers Workshop, and I went to TSR AOL back when that was the main gaming online networking tool I could find. And through that, I wrote reviews of Alternity for TSR, which meant I was putting my name in front of people who had hiring power. And later, when I went to apply for a job, one of the reasons they gave me an interview is that they knew I'd been at the writer's workshop. I had sat down for lunch with Stan and Ted. At the workshop, I had talked to Dave Gross at Gen Con the previous year. So they had some idea who I was. If you know someone, by all means, ask them if there's something useful you can do for them. And there are lots and lots. I mean, there are multiple publishers on this chat right now. So there are potentially a lot of people out there. You never know when someone might say, hey, if you can write up 101 weird things to find in a giant's pocket, I would like to see that. And that can be rule neutral even. So there are ways to go about without it, but I personally think the self-promotion is important. I also personally, my Facebook is, you know, my name, my blog is my name, my Twitter handle is my name. because if I decided that I was going to be, you know, Captain Obese 47, and that's what I was going to put on everything, people might be a fan of my work. And when they meet me in person or I approach them about work, would have no idea they liked me because they were used to thinking of me as this weird icon and this online title. Again, there are people that do that, and I'm not saying that you can't get ahead if you do it, but I do think it's very, very useful if you're getting your name out there to use whatever your professional name is going to be.
Yeah, if I go back and do things differently, I would have named this the Fainting Goat Podcast, because I still run into people regularly who don't know that Banff Podcast and Fainting Goat Games are run by the same guy.
Exactly.
So. Yeah. I have the same issue with my DeviantArt in that it's under my old moniker, which is Prodigy Duck, when I started it, and then I became famous, and now I have to explain what Prodigy Duck is.
I guess.
Jacob, are you famous?
I have hundreds of loyal fans.
Infamous.
I guess I have a good head start on the fact that I've kept my moniker for 15 years, so people know La La Twiddle and I are synonymous at this point. So.
Well, and it's like Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Parham. Every time he's doing No Direction, he says, Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Parham. So every time he's driving home, hey, these are the two names I'm known under. Again, I'm not saying that it won't work, but I do think, again, it's doing not necessarily doing things the easy way. For example, there was a writer, still is, whose professional name is Lizard. And I know people, publishers, who won't work with him because they don't want their author page to say Lizard. They don't think it looks professional. And you can say, well, if they don't want to call me what I want to be called, I don't want to work with them, and that's great. But again, when you're talking about easiest practices rather than somehow ethically best practices, I think having a single name, as long as you're comfortable with that name, helps.
Hey, just curious, given your connections and your breadth of experience, you meet a lot of people. Have you considered branching out into comic books or fiction the way some other folks have in recent years, even some folks at Green Ronin?
I always meant to write fiction. That was the plan. But I applied for both fiction writing gigs and RPG writing gigs. And for about a decade, I was always turned down for fiction writing and I was always accepted for RPGs. I am still planning on making that transition. I'm still planning on writing more fiction. I've been doing more and more small fiction. I plan to make a big run at NaNoWriMo here in about a week and a half. And I do have some contacts that I've been talking to about doing fiction. So that is now a definite part of my plan over the next year to make sure I actually move forward on that. Comics, I don't know. For example, Jacob is going to be drawing some comics for Rogue Genius that we are going to be doing as ads, like the old one-page TSR comics, which, you know, part of it is that is because I saw the hostess snack cake jokes from the Fainting Goat things, and I thought to myself, what else was done in that era that I really liked? And I thought of those old TSR. They'd be two or three panels of some sort of dungeon adventure and end on a cliffhanger. So I'm going to write those, and Jacob will be drawing them, and we will use those, for example, in Pathways Magazine and online, and just use it as advertising and to put eyeballs on things. I don't know if I want to try to break into comics in general at the moment, because it's, yeah, those. I think those are brilliant. It's just absolutely brilliant, and I love them. But I also think probably there are a lot of fans who won't get the joke because, you know, we're old.
Well, there's not a ton of young people playing RPGs. Maybe more since Wendy's is into the game now. But
I was about to say, I just don't think that's true. The beginner boxes seem to frequently skew quite young. Every time I go to Gen Con, there's always children playing in every big room of people playing. Paizo actually has a junior players organized play. I think there are a lot of kids playing RPGs, and I think there have to be, or else the hobby will die out.
Well, I certainly hope that's true. I just I talk to, you know, teenagers or younger kids, and I hear about Minecraft, I hear about Pokemon, and I don't hear a lot about, hey, let's get together and roll some dice, but I sure hope it's happening out there.
Well, there's actually... Go ahead, Owen.
No, you go.
There's actually quite a few servers on Discord focused around teenage and early 20s RPGers. I am actually in four of them that have a very large population of people under 22. We actually had three different people apply for to show up on BWK that were 18 and under. They were 16 to 17, sorry. And we had to turn them down because we don't want underage kids. So I do know there is a large population of youth out there.
And No Thank You Evils had, what, two successful Kickstarters as a child's game?
So far.
I mean, in the 80s, when I first started role-playing, if you had asked a bunch of kids what they did, you would have heard about Atari and maybe laser tag and how much they loved Star Wars and Dark Tower even, and they wouldn't have said D&D, but they were out there playing.
I love Dark Tower. That was the best.
I still think that one of the things that could have saved 4th edition D&D is if they had made a Dark Tower automatic dungeon master. Because the game was rigid enough that you could have gotten most of that play experience like they did with the board games, with a central computerized dungeon master that randomized these adventures.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, let's look to the future. You're doing Fantasy Age for Green Ronin. We have the spell cards coming out and a mysterious products line. Future releases we can't talk about. We know they're not Krull. Let's talk about what Rogue Genius Game and Owen's Patreon are doing right now.
So Owen's Patreon is specifically for people to support my free online writing. So I write a great deal of content on Twitter and on Facebook, just as part of engagement, and then bigger things invariably end up on my blog. At the level I'm at, I do one larger article every Monday, and then a small sort of chunky rules analysis bit Tuesday through Friday. People at the $10 level get a PDF of every piece of free content I have done for the previous month. So every tweet, every Facebook post, every weird little list of 101 weird mimics all gets gathered together for them, and they get it in one place, which also means I have all that content gathered up because I had to get a friend to go troll and crawl LiveJournal to get all of my content off of it because I had just had it on LiveJournal and nowhere else. Luckily, I've got it backed up now. But the base level, I tell you all when I've got free blogs up and people can tell me what they want to write, what they want to hear. Sometimes you get previews of stuff or a little extra content, like I did 101 mimics on Twitter and Facebook, but I threw some extra mimics in when I compiled them for the Patreon folks. And if that gets to a higher level, I will be spending even more time and basically making it my part-time job to keep my patrons happy. Rogue Genius is going forward with a fair amount of Starfinder and Pathfinder 1st and 2nd edition content. We've been doing the Monster Omnicrons, where we've been saying you've got a new game, you need new monsters for Pathfinder 2nd edition, where we've been letting some creators kind of go wild and we say, hey, here are the things we have illustrations for. What do you want to make them? And letting their imaginations run wild. While still putting together a solid and useful set of stats for the product. And those are short and cheap because I think frequently people don't need 500 monsters. They just need the one right monster. We've got ongoing Starfinder content. We're still in 1st edition Pathfinder stuff. Michael Sayer, who's written for us before, did the Grimoire Arcane, which was to take the... Yeah, there's our drive-through page, which has everything on it, broken into categories mostly. Take the wizard, and instead of just having wizard who can be specialist, actually broke it down into 8 subclasses, alternate classes. So like the ninja is an alternate class of the rogue, our necromancer is an alternate class for the wizard so that you can really get more in depth with what your connection to that school of magic is. And that's for 1st edition. We're going to keep doing 1st edition content as long as people want to see it.
Are you leery about getting into Pathfinder 2nd edition content, or is the time just not right, you don't think? Or,
well, I mean, we're already doing the Monster Omnicrons. We've already had some stuff from Everybody Games, who they are their own publisher, but we publish them, although they are their own game company. They've done some feats and stuff. So we've got some stuff up. What I'm trying to see is what do people want? So there will be, and we have Writing with Style, which is a great book if you are a beginning RPG writer. It is specifically a 20-year editing veteran of the RPG industry, his advice to RPG writers. And I mean, I still learn new things when I read this book, so I'm delighted. I pestered him for 2 or 3 years to get him to write it.
I just figured, since we're doing a creative process podcast, editing is one of those things that's overlooked sometimes, especially with RPG writing. So it's,
yeah, editing is huge. And development is huge. And they're sometimes they're the same thing and sometimes they're different things. But Ray is a great editor, and he's got a lot of practical experience in a lot of different game systems. So that is one of my favorite things that we publish.
Just a quick question. We're getting close to the top of the hour, and I will need to smoke bomb and run away to get back to my paying day job. When you look around at the RPG industry right now, the offerings out there, is there a certain niche you think to yourself, someone should be really doing books about this, and they're not? Or are those books you're already writing at Rogue Genius Games if you find a niche for Killer Clowns or Science Fiction Cowboys or whatever?
I do think that some of those weirder, smaller niches are available. If I've got a really good idea for one, I'll either give it to Alex Agunas for Everybody Games or I'll keep it to myself. The thing that really strikes me right now is the real ascension of the Actual Play podcast, which has become a huge part of the industry. And it looks to me like there is going to be, at least potentially, more money in podcasts about playing games than there are in making the games. And it's easy to want to be salty about that, but that's a lot like when radio and movies came out, right? And there was more money in making movies than there was in writing the books that the movies were based off of. It's a slightly different entertainment industry, but I think we have still not yet found the game company that is really maximizing that. And that's, of course, because game companies are full of people who are good at and want to and experience that making games. They are not necessarily good at and full of people that want to do actual play podcasts. But I think one of the things that I did when I was with Paizo is I worked on Oblivion Oath, where we were doing an actual play of Pathfinder 2nd Edition that we started weeks before the game came out. And people were very involved in learning the game by watching us play it. Learning an RPG is one of the trickiest parts of getting people into this hobby. And one answer is to have beginner boxes, and one answer is to not have 600-page RPGs to begin with. But I also think that one answer is that if you've got a new game or a new product coming out, there's a lot to be said for finding some entertaining people to play with it in a way that creates a show people will watch. Not everyone will watch it, but that's a market that I think is going to be more important.
I, at this point, I should mention that the talented Miss Alice Peng and her husband Brandon Powers run Babies with Knives, an actual play podcast.
Exactly. As we do character creation, and we also do crash courses where we specifically have a concise way of teaching you a system as well.
And I think that is very much going to be a big part of the industry going forward.
And thanks for the mention.
It seemed like a good place to do it. So I think we're just about wrapping up. Did anyone have any closing thoughts or whatnot before we hit the big red button and call it a day?
We should probably have Owen on the Babies with Knives so he can run a session of Fantasy Age.
I actually was already just hitting friend request with him and sending him a message. I'm one of those that... I've hated the self-promoting job. This is the worst part of BWK for me, but I understand I have to do it.
I am reasonably sure we'll manage to make something work out.
Fantastic. We'd love to have you on.
Sure.
All right. And Walt, Jacob, anything? All right.
There are no projects that I'm currently working on that I am allowed to talk about.
You can talk about the two centaurs if you want.
Owen has hired me to draw more Western art for him. I'm going to be drawing some centaurs, with some cowboy and cowgirl centaurs for real world, the real Wild West. Otherwise, you know, I'm still doing stuff for Rogue Genius Games with Superpowered Legends. I've got a Superpowered Bestiary product that I have in the works. Yeah, that's it for me.
Okay. I had to get one more in.
Just gonna look at that. Look at that poster. Don't you want to play that?
It's gorgeous.
That's
beautiful. Okay.
Just putting it out there. Hey, do you ever consider having like gangs of roving desperado centaurs in your Wild West setting? Because that just seems like a lot of fun.
Yes, we're absolutely thinking. That's why I'm getting art.
Okay, fair enough.
There will be a blog post about centaurs in Really Wild West once I've got art.
All right, cool. Great minds think alike, as they say. But so do lunatics. So anyway, hey, thanks for tuning in to watch the Banff podcast. To all of our listeners, Owen, we love having you on. We'd love to have you on, you know, whenever you want to come on. It's always a great pleasure talking to you, sir.
Thank you very much. Very much appreciate you having me. Always have fun.
Very nice meeting you.
Nice to meet you, too.
And to our listeners and viewers, we'll catch you next time on the Banff podcast.